Welcome to Healthcare by the Numbers, a podcast that uncovers what's driving healthcare transformation. Join us each episode as Caravan Health leaders interview the brightest minds inspiring healthcare innovation and discuss the numbers which have shaped their thinking. Welcome, everyone. I'm your host, Todd Searles, Vice President for Business Development at Caravan Health. And this is Healthcare by the Numbers, a podcast that explores the numbers driving change throughout our industry. To learn more about Caravan Health, this podcast, and to check out episodes of the show, visit caravanhealth.com. Be sure to sign up for our newsletter to get notified of future episodes. You can also visit our program page on Healthcare Now Radio. Follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook under our username at Caravan Health. Today, we're talking about healthcare costs, which is anyone who's familiar with Caravan Health. This is at the heart of what we do. Our company specializes in helping community health systems to transform their care delivery, to save money, to improve quality of care through accountable care. And so we are delighted to welcome Dan Weissman, the host of Arm and a Leg podcast, which digs into all aspects of the cost of healthcare, and with a special focus on the impact to us as consumers and as patients. Welcome to the podcast, Dan.
Thanks, Todd. Great to be here.
You betcha. I've listened to your podcast. Cool. I am absolutely enamored with your take on looking at, you know, the industry as a whole, what we as patients can do to become better educated. But for those listeners who are not yet familiar with Dan and his podcast or your work before that, you've had a long career as a radio journalist. You started back, let's see, I don't know, years ago, we'll say, and have worked in places such as Marketplace and Planet Money. And then just recently in 2018, you started a very successful, something I think is often actionable, definitely humorous, while also sobering, the Arm and a Leg podcast. And it delves into the spiraling cost of healthcare and its impact on everyday Americans. I think your show does a really good job of highlighting and seeking answers that solve, you know, the very common struggles that you and I and everyone else experience as patients within our healthcare system. I know that you're often joined by some of the biggest names in healthcare policy, but I do love the fact that based on one show, it seems to be almost a waterfall effect where you'll get comments from some of your visitors and listeners who are hidden experts. And you bring them onto the show to spotlight that experience and their knowledge in order to continue to help others. So I want to thank you again, Dan. I really do enjoy your work. And so I'm looking forward to this few minutes that we have together. You had a great career, I think, as a radio journalist. And perhaps you can give our audience just a little bit more background as to how you came, you know, to the Arm and a Leg podcast from having worked, you know, in Marketplace and Planet Money and things like that.
Well, thank you so much for saying such nice things about the show. I really, really appreciate it. And yeah, I mean, I think I'm still essentially a radio journalist, and I still do stories for NPR on topics like this. And everything I do kind of comes out of the tradition of journalism and public radio journalism, especially. And, you know, I ended up doing this because this is partly, number one, this is an issue for my own family. You know, for one thing, my wife and I have both made major career decisions because of health insurance, not just like changing jobs, but big career shifts. And also, as a reporter, it's been really clear to me for a long time, right? This is, I mean, it's kind of an enormously important story. It's not like I'm alone in structuring my life around the cost of healthcare. I don't even have it especially rough. And B, these stories are, they're really relatable and intimate. Like, they're stories about our bodies and our bank accounts. Doesn't get any more personal than that. And they raise questions about the very biggest ways our society is organized, you know, like public policy and politics and economics. And there's this level of nerdy complexity, you know, science and medicine and business structures, which appeals to me. So this idea of exploring all these questions at once, like why does it cost so much? Why is it such a mess? You know, it speaks to all these things I'm drawn to. It's important. It affects everybody. Intimate stories, nerdy complexity, professionally. And because it's tied to me personally, I'm like, yes, let's do this. And it also seemed to me that starting a show about it made sense because there hasn't been, I think, a kind of sustained conversation for non-specialists in traditional media outlets. Like, in the course of just reading the news, we usually come across like three types of stories, like individual outrages or tragedies, which, you know, could be like, well, this thing happened to this person, or this hospital or clinic was doing this horrible thing. That's one. There's also political horse race stories. Oh, will the Biden administration do this? How will Republicans respond? And kind of like business page stories that sneak into our Twitter feeds of like, CVS is buying this other company. And I think as lay people, we're like, that sounds like it could affect me, but I just have no idea how. Like, what does it mean? And all of these stories for most of us just raise a lot of questions about what is going on. And then on, and because of the way, you know, news media is structured, that's all you are, you know, that kind of ongoing conversation doesn't happen so much. But that ongoing conversation seemed to me like it would be important for any of us, including me, if we were going to come close to any answers. And the other thing that became clear to me as I was starting to think about how to do the project was, it's really got to be more entertaining and empowering and useful than enraging and terrifying and depressing, because we all have a lot to deal with. And no, and if it's a podcast, you're not just coming across it, you know, in the course of watching 60 Minutes or listening to All Things Considered or whatever. You're gonna have to choose it, and so that's been an intention so far. Does that answer the question of how?
Yeah, it does. It absolutely does. I think, you know, that's one of the things that draws, I think, people to not only your podcast, but the whole topic of healthcare, where we are today in America. You know, everyday Americans face sometimes the life and death decision of, do I pay for my utilities, right? It's an often used expression, or do I pay for my medicine, or do I get food? And and one of the things we'll spotlight here in a second, as part of our numbers segment, is, you know, the spiraling amount of medical debt, which forces families to undergo bankruptcy, right? As part of just wanting to get healthy from a disease or a condition that, in the way our healthcare is set up, it'll bankrupt them. I mean, myself, to your point, right? So I'm very keen on these, on the numbers, as it were. My own family, actually my parents, had to go through a medical bankruptcy.
Oh, Jesus.
You know, which is, I mean, it's ridiculous to think about, right? One of the most, you know, what can we say, historic, overall time, successful experiments in democracy in a country. And here we are with a huge debt burden amongst every single American because of the cost of just keeping ourselves healthy and alive. And it is something, I think it touches on the intrinsic need to care for one another's. And so that's why I'm excited that you did go down this path and give that space and that voice to people to be able to express themselves. I think, you know, to kind of highlight just how bad it is, you know, we like to spotlight inside of the Healthcare by the Numbers podcast some numbers. And as we've just talked about, we spend an enormous amount on healthcare in the US, totaling $3.8 trillion in 2019, which for everyday Americans is about $11,500 out of their pocket every single year for office visits, minor and major procedures, premium payments, and things like that. That's 17.7% of our entire economy. And yet, when we look at the next closest country, it's Switzerland, spending 12% of their GDP. And you have to ask yourselves, I mean, the numbers are staggering. What are we buying in the healthcare space that perhaps is making us healthier for that amount of money compared to, say, Switzerland or some other large, you know, first world country? And I think as we look again year over year, just like in the past, the amount of healthcare spend just keeps going up. We keep aging, which is a good thing, right? We don't want the alternative. But the rise in expenses has affected the American household. I mean, nearly 20% of American households have been sent to collections over medical debt. And just like my family, nearly 10% declaring bankruptcy at some point just because the debt burden was too high. So, and what there is no worse, I think, testament to this than the fact that one third of GoFundMe crowdsourcing is for healthcare expenses. I mean, that has become one of the largest insurers, you know, if you want to call it that, across America, with 40% of our households not even being able to handle a $400 unexpected medical bill. So I think you touch on it perfectly. It is very personal. It touches on the two things you don't want most people to know about: how much money's in your bank account and, you know, what's going on inside of our skin, right? So, you know, those are the numbers. I mean, when you sit back and look at all the stories that you've shared, what has stood out to you, not only about these numbers, but about those stories and, you know, at the end of this day, we'll hopefully end on an optimistic note, but what has led you from these stories to perhaps solutions and everything in between?
I mean, well, these numbers are horrifying, right? And that question of like, what do we get for the extra increment of GDP that we spend? I mean, there's tons of evidence that, like, it's not working out for us, right? Like our outcomes in terms of how healthy we are, how long we live, you know, maternal mortality rates, all kinds of things we don't compare so favorably to places that spend less as a portion of their entire national wealth on healthcare. And there's lots of evidence. And, you know, one number that I've seen compared with that number of like $11,500 for every person spent on the healthcare system is we spend about $56 a person on public health every year. Right. So, you know, that's a problem.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think gosh.
Yeah. It makes you, whether they say verklempt. Verklempt.
Yes, that's a good word. That's a good word. Yeah, no, it's frustrating. It can be overwhelming. One thing that's happened as I've been doing the show for longer is, you know, when I started, I thought like, oh, you know, there's all this interesting nerdy complexity and stories. This will be like a kind of ticked off Planet Money, but for healthcare. And, you know, and there is a lot of that to explore. But after the first couple of seasons, we said, my collaborators and I were like, you know, we should start focusing on self-defense. Like, what can we do in the here and now to protect ourselves from all these things that can come for us? Because, as I put it at the time, you know, the cavalry's not coming. You know, we made this turn in 2019. So at that point, the 2020 presidential election was a good ways away. And I was like, you know, if your dream candidate, whoever that might be, were to win a landslide victory with a giant legislative wave behind them to enact were dedicated to enacting your dream legislation. Well, that was, you know, 2019. Like, the inauguration was still a year and a half away, and it takes time to pass legislation and to implement it. I mean, you were still looking at years before you'd see your dreams come true. And with conditions like we have, where, again, as you say, 40% of people can't handle a $400 unexpected medical bill. And that's, you know, $400 is like, you know, the ante for a medical bill usually. So, you know, that meant that we're all in danger or, you know, just many of us are in real danger, and we got to figure it out now. And again, all of that was on the premise that, like, the absolute moonshot best case scenario, whatever your idea of it was, which, you know, so far, I don't think that's really working out for anybody. I don't think we're looking at a kind of moonshot best case scenario. So yeah, we got to focus more and more on, you know, what can we do to protect ourselves? And what we've narrowed, you know, the pandemic happened, and that gave us a bunch to chew on much more immediately. Like, what does that mean? Like, what kind of exposure do we have? What if I have to be treated in a field hospital at the local sports arena was a question we got from a listener in the very early days. Like, who says they're going to take my insurance? Like, what the heck is going on? So, you know, raised all kinds of questions. We've come back to really focusing on this stuff, and it's interesting. I mean, it turns out we have as what I'll call consumers, although we're not in a traditional consumer relationship with, you know, it's kind of a your money or your life situation with healthcare providers, it feels like. But we have legal rights that I don't think most of us are completely aware of, and that also we don't always have a lot of ways to enforce. Because it's not like if you could hire a lawyer to fight this medical bill, you could pay the medical bill. So, but we've been finding a bunch of interesting places, like hacks, like bits of wiggle room that we do have and that we can learn more about. And that I find super interesting. So, and encouraging. And it's like, oh man, like, you know, good. The show can be more entertaining and empowering and useful than enraging and terrifying and depressing.
So well, absolutely.
That's kind of where we've kind of taken things recently.
I really did mean in the opening, you know, it's actionable, right? You had a great episode, I think, on nonprofit hospitals, right? Mm-hmm. And what they are legally required to do if people are struggling. And we work with a ton of nonprofit facilities within the healthcare space. And they are always, sometimes, you know, they are overwhelmed just like every healthcare system, but they are almost always willing to engage with patients once they know the full story, but it amazes me as how many patients, you know, my parents, any person perhaps raised at a generation where you don't question the doctor, right? Sometimes in today's world, you have to question. You have to question the bill. You have to question the treatment. You know, we spend so much on healthcare that it begs the question, it's this way in Congress all the time, how much of that is being wasted, or how much of it is something that the patient themselves may not necessarily need? You know, do you need to get your shoulder replaced, or is it maybe just a rotator cuff, or is it just physical therapy, right? And you'd be right as rain and moving back on. But if a, you know, perhaps if you go to a surgeon and they tell you you need surgery, you just take it for, you know, as gospel. I mean, in the stories and the expert that you talk to, are you seeing a shift in more educated patients and their willingness to stand up for their rights?
I don't think it's a wave, right? I mean, I think we're, as you said, like most of us are just, we're in a situation when we get a bill, we get a medical bill of like, what am I going to do about this? And to your point of like, well, you know, nonprofit hospitals will want to work with people who have financial need. I mean, there appears to be a very wide range. So one thing I learned, you know, in reporting that story about charity care is that there are a bunch of hospitals that actually like, they're on the lookout for people who might need financial aid because they'd prefer to like, if they know coming right up that like, you're not going to be able to pay this bill, then they can save themselves a lot of labor in trying to chase you for it. And save you some trouble, which I think, you know, nice of them. And, you know, they can earn some community goodwill. They might be able to qualify for certain extra federal reimbursements by doing more than their share of charity care. So they have incentives to do it. But, you know, there are hospitals that do that, and there are hospitals that totally don't, right, that hide the ball. There was one hospital I learned about that was sued by their state attorney general for really withholding charity care that they were obligated to, you know, provide some form of. So they trained the people at reception and billing that if a patient were to ask you for a charity care application, you come back with, you know what, we need to talk about what you could pay.
Wow.
We need to talk about setting you up on a payment plan. And they were trained to do that 3 times before essentially acknowledging the request if you were to bring it up a 4th time. And then the application itself was so complex that one patient described it as like a book. And she remembered a question of like, what's the make and model of your car? Which suggested to her that she was like, am I supposed to sell my car to pay the medical bill here? You know, it's, and there are, you know, I've certainly seen, because other reporters have uncovered it, you know, a significant number of hospitals that just chase patients as far as you can imagine, to the point of suing people and garnishing their wages, which are often not very much, and putting liens on their houses. So, yeah, I mean, this kind of thinking of ourselves as being in this adversarial relationship, this adversarial financial relationship with a healthcare provider, it's uncomfortable for good reason, right? You want to be in partnership with your doctor. Yep. And I hear from doctors all the time, including some who are complaining about, like, when I'm the patient, I'm in this position too. And some of them are like, I happen to know that, like, I'm kind of reluctant to call the doc on the other side to get this straightened out because I know that they're probably just trying to get dinner with their family and they already are, like, way stacked up. Like, it's a mess. It's a mess. When you talk about waste, I mean, one thing, there was an economist who did a study for the Bernie Sanders campaign a couple of years ago. And one of the questions that he looked at was, like, he said, I want to be intellectually honest here. So if we were to look at, you know, what if we had Medicare for all, like, what would be some of the downsides? And one of the downsides is like, well, you know, about 1.2 million people would lose their jobs, per his estimate, because that's the number of people he estimated are employed on the one hand in the offices of healthcare providers, arguing with insurance companies about who should pay what, and their counterparts working for insurance companies arguing the same thing. And I looked up like, well, how does that compare? Like, that's a significant, that seems like a big number. I was right. Like, how does that compare to the number of jobs that we, you know, think we saved by bailing out the U.S. auto industry? And the answer is it's more, like significantly more jobs. So that's, you know, which isn't to say that like we should run our healthcare system like it's, you know, an employment program. You know,
right.
We should aim to find other things for those people to do. And I've talked to people who have those jobs who are like, you got to have a job. I don't love doing this. So, it's a problem. I think the idea that you've raised that like people overuse medical services is something we hear a fair amount of, but I don't think that's so commonplace. Given the number of people, certainly there's large swaths of the population who are like would never consider doing anything like that because I can't, how would I possibly afford the share of the bill that's going to come to me?
Yeah, it's a great point. It's a great point. And I think, with our clients, you often, frequent flyers to the ED, unmanaged healthcare conditions, but an ED visit somehow will get written off, but they can't get their prescriptions up front. That's one class. You have the other class that, just won't take care of themselves, perhaps, and it does. It over, what do I want to say? It overweights, the healthcare system with that, and I can't remember the exact numbers, but that high top of the percentage of spend goes to the least percentage of people.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think when you raise that of like people showing up at the emergency room because that's the only place they know they can show up, and not be turned away. I think about or people who don't take care of themselves. I think about who this guy Paul Farmer is.
I don't.
He's a doctor who created a group called Partners in Health, and he's profiled in this really incredible book called Mountains Beyond Mountains that I read a long time ago. He started a clinic in Haiti. And he's since created clinics elsewhere. And his he when he did his MD, he also did a degree in medical anthropology, did a PhD. And his take was like, look, the cost, even clinics in Haiti were low cost compared to anything you see in the United States, but people are really, really poor. And that if you run your clinic and you're like, well, people have to come here and get the prescription and they have to do what we tell them, and they have to pay this nominal amount. Like all those things compared to what people's resources are really, really high cost, right? Like taking a day away from subsistence labor to get to the clinic is a really high cost proposition. Taking this medicine that puts you out of commission from doing 16 hours a day of sustenance labor is a really high cost proposition. And dealing with somebody who treats you as less than a human being, doesn't incline you to make the necessary sacrifices to do those things. And he was like, look, if we take seriously that our job is to be a healer, we gotta come to people where they are. We can't allow ourselves to sit up in our tower and make it a high cost proposition for people to get into partnership with us. And I'm super influenced by that. And he's like, look, you're gonna the consequence of not making that effort is what we have, right? Where people don't neglect their health on purpose. Nobody wants to be unhealthy. People see the barriers to participating to finding a somebody who's going to be their partner, and it's not manageable. It's not conceivable. I mean, people would love to follow other doctors' orders. Everybody would love to send their kids to the fanciest private school, but like, guess what? It's like it's not like it turns out that not everybody can. The costs, the people have to look at, maybe, I mean, not me, but probably a lot of people would like to drive the best car in the world. Like people, the healthcare, not all of healthcare is different from all those things. It's not a consumer good, but the cost of accessing real care is really high, especially because, there's just issues with quality. I mean, that is what I would say. Like you go see somebody and like you gotta figure out, is this person somebody who's really gonna work with me? I mean, doctors talk all the time, nurses talk all the time, about that care isn't patient-centered. And that's a cost. That imposes costs.
Well,
So yeah, I mean, that's my spiel. I know you're the expert.
No, yeah, and amen, right? Preach it, brother. I think it's fascinating to me to pick up on what you just talked about, right? So you're, you know, manual labor, how much is it actually going to, the risk reward calculation that immediately and almost instantaneously goes on in a person's head when they're living in that situation. We see it sometimes in rural areas where, you know, perhaps there's limited access to care. They work out on a ranch or a farm. The nearest clinic is 25 miles away. Are they going to take off and go in, you know, during the quote unquote normal business hours when they could get a normal visit? No, they've got things to do, right? And perhaps they don't have insurance that would pay them, you know, to take a day off, sick time. Because it's a cash-based economy, or you have people who live in inner city. I worked in Kansas City at the zoo one time a long time ago in the past, and probably I would say a third of the workforce took the bus. So if you get sick at work, you know, and you need to go to the doctor, that you have to pull up the bus schedule and take a look and see where you're going. And these are sometimes the things that I wonder as we sit back and we talk about healthcare policy and we talk about improving care. What's been very rewarding, I think, to see is over time, the social determinants of health, which, you know, we always talk about that as a major driver. But for people who truly understand it, it goes so much beyond perhaps the type of food that they eat. Not that that's not important, but it's where they live. It's how they can access caregivers. It's where is that copay going to come from? And the stress that, you know, just wraps all of that up with an unfortunate bow, right? And how that stress will then exacerbate a condition that they have. I'm kind of curious if you've, if on your podcast, you've, I mean, it's always underlined, right? The stress of not being able to meet whatever it requires to get healthcare. I mean, have you had episodes in which you've talked specifically about managing that stress?
Well, one thing that I think about when you say that are people with type 1 diabetes, which having now, you know, had occasion to meet and talk with folks about their journey, mostly around, like, you know, I've met, essentially the people I've met have been people who are kind of like superheroes of, you know, I met them because they have hacks. They've worked out kind of miraculous sounding hacks to be able to access care even when they don't have a lot of money. Mm-hmm. To access, you know, be able to take care of them even when they don't have a lot of money. But, like, you know, having type 1 diabetes is, I mean, the thing we hear about and think about mostly is, like, insulin is just so incredibly expensive unless you have the right kind of insurance and have the, which includes having insurance that kind of where the deductibles and other kind of out-of-pocket stuff, you know, is a reasonable match for your actual income. I mean, there's that, but, like, you know, I was talking last week with a woman who was like, yeah, so I, you know, I'm in this job, I have the insurance and I save, but, like, I also, like, I never go on vacation. I never, you know, I'm decorated. She's 50 some years old. I'm decorated in early college because she's like, I got to see the doc. I have like 12 doctor visits a quarter. And, you know, she manages everything that she's devoted considerable time to actually, like, learning as part of a community of people to, like, hack the continuous glucose monitors and automatic insulin pumps to make them perform better, right? Because her condition requires her to essentially be a research scientist and a computer scientist and a technologist, and that's just that's just managing the levels of insulin and glucose in her blood, you know, day to day, hour to hour. But there's all kinds of complications that, you know, become part of your life, you know, because diabetes is hard on your body.
Yep.
So, yeah, not exactly. You asked me, like, what do people, are people hard up against it? Are people, like, fine? Yeah, like, people are, it's tough, but people are resourceful, people are resilient, and the system that we have is just not, you know, it. A colleague of mine, Daisy Rosario, says, you know, likes to say, like, we don't have a system. It's just a bunch of stuff that we do. And I think that's true.
Yeah.
And the thing that I've, you know, come to think about a lot is that, you know, people respond to incentives. And that the incentives that, you know, when you talk about the millions of people who work in this system have, you know, it's built to create incentives for, it's not built to create incentives for people to do the right thing. We would not have, you know, an opioid epidemic if our incentives were correctly aligned.
Yep.
So it sounds, I mean, my impression of what, you know, the actor that you work with, that you're aiming to kind of, you know, create at least more outfits that are able to correctly align incentives.
That's correct. Yeah.
So, you
And, you
know,
know, to
great. Like, I hope, like, I wish all the success to you in that endeavor. It's, and I imagine, like, I should listen to your podcast. I imagine it's an uphill battle because, again, our non-system, you know, seems to me like it is just filled with misaligned incentives. If
Yes.
our objective is like more people in better health and less misery.
Right. You know, people taking control of their healthcare is a common phrase, you know, that you'll hear a lot of, but you have to be educated, right? You have to know what perhaps you don't even know, and you have to be educated to know how to express that. And I think working within my own family, working with clients who are definitely learning new ways to engage patients in their care, whether or not it's through technology or perhaps, you know, perhaps for the 89-year-olds who don't want to embody
Oh,
technology,
yeah,
you know,
right.
through just a telephone call, right? That it gets back down to the person-centric practice of medicine. And I think we are starting to see a shift for those early adopters, right? You'll always have those people who have waited for this opportunity to change their system, to get rid of some of this, you know, what seem to be misaligned incentives, and to do the right thing because that is where their heart is. And then, like you previously mentioned, that healthcare system that was purposely doing the wrong thing. We have to highlight and expose those groups, and we have to then, you know, show that they are the, you know, they're the dinosaur that is going away. And it's going to take a while. I mean, everybody knows it's, you know, it didn't get this way overnight. It's not going to change overnight. But, you know, you had touched on briefly, and I think I know we're probably going to be coming to the end of our time here. But, you know, as we look at this, there has to be bright spots along the way. I can, you know, think of a number of our clients, their population health nurses, for instance, who once they implemented team-based care to do the right thing, right? Spend more time with their patients. They start sharing stories that can just, you know, melt your heart and remind us why healthcare truly is a very personal thing that can inspire us if it's done correctly. Do you have any stories, you know, that have just stood out to you over your years of doing this that are like, you know what, we are broken, but we're getting better?
Huh. Well, I don't know. I mean, the stories that I know of are just, I don't know that I could ever, I mean, we're talking about a sixth of our economy, right? $3.8 trillion. There's no one story about any of that.
Yeah.
But I, you know, there's, yeah, I mean, it's my job really to look for like, where's the wiggle room? Where's the hope? What can we do more of? And the good news is there's just so much of it. And, you know, the folks, you know, we're re-releasing, as I talk with you, an episode I did very early on about insulin and how it came to be discovered and how it came to be so expensive and what people are doing about it. And you know, I reconnected with some of the people I talked with for that episode, people who are you know, type 1 diabetics who are pursuing projects. And it's, I mean, it's and in a year and a half, you know, people have come a long way, and it's kind of awesome. So this woman who, you know, has this like open source rig to control her glucose monitor and her insulin pump. You know, she said she used to spend a lot of time. She said she spent years learning the coding required to make that stuff work. And there was a community of people there to help her. And she, you know, made time when I was talking to her to give back, you know, to help other people learn to use this equipment. And she said in the last year and a half, like, she hasn't been spending as much time doing that because this stuff has gotten so much easier to use. Like, it's working.
Yeah.
And so and it's also gotten more sophisticated, so that she now instead of having this thing that she built herself, in a little eyeglass case, a little, it looks like a raw motherboard with an antenna on it, you know, she now has this little thing in a case that, you know, some guy makes and kind of sells at a very reasonable cost, you know, that does the job, that kind of helps everything communicate. Instead of having to be logged onto her computer, she manages it all through a smartphone app. There's more automation in it. And so she says, like, the upshot is, she's like, I think about diabetes a lot less than I used to every day.
How much less stress would that be?
I mean, it's kind of, I mean, it's great. It's
Yeah.
great. The, like, another person I talked to was part of a group that is trying to create an open source recipe for insulin. And they actually have made pretty interesting progress, and it's essentially a volunteer effort. And they have been working from like biohacker makerspaces, and they have a grant from the city of Baltimore to kind of start implementing some of their vision. They've been one of the things that came up, in my reporting was people were like, "Well, good luck getting the FDA and the DEA to let you distribute any of that." And they're talking with regulators and legislators about finding ways and figuring out how to steer their project in directions that would allow them to actually, distribute
Sure.
this community-made insulin. And he asked the kind of project founder, said to me, I think we're a few years and a few million dollars away from being able to do this. He's like, that's comparable to like putting in a new stretch of road in a small town.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, right? I mean, that's
Yeah.
pretty, that's amazing. That's
Well, they say what? Necessity is the mother of invention. And what a sad testament, but a great
yeah.
testament to their ingenuity, but a sad testament that we've gotten to that point in American healthcare where you have to hack insulin to make it affordable,
It's, I mean,
right?
it's un it's, I mean, especially given that the scientists who discovered it were very explicit that they did not want anybody making a profit off it.
Wow.
So
Well,
it's
kudos to her, kudos to that community. I mean, it is by their grace and efforts that, perhaps my child's children will be, who need insulin will be getting it without any cost or, something that's.
do you have grandkids who need insulin?
No. I
You're
mean,
saying
my son right now is 11, so
okay.
hopefully he lives a happy, healthy life. He does have, though, one of his best friends actually in school is child diabetes and juvenile diabetes and has the insulin pump automated and things like that. And I couldn't imagine being a parent who has to worry about cost, about that technology failing, things like that, right? And once again, that goes to the stress, which contributes to this condition. And I am optimistic that the industry is trying to find better ways to do it, even if it is the patients, like you just said, that are leading that charge.
Yeah, people are resilient. I mean, can I tell you one more story?
Sure.
Yeah. So our most recent episode, as we talked, you talked about it as an episode about nonprofit hospitals. I think it's an episode about, I think it's a story about, local ingenuity, kind of finding a way and finding these spaces, finding this wiggle room. Because that story is really, to me, like this guy became kind of social media famous overnight. He posted a TikTok video that said like, "Hey, here's something you might not know. If you make under a certain amount of money, you should be able to get your hospital bill written off. Here's how." And he kind of showed you in a 60-second video how to, find the financial assistance policy for your hospital to kind of, hit Control F to kind of find the place in the document where it would say what the income cutoffs were, and that you could then go apply. And he's been doing this for years for people locally where he lives in Portland, Oregon. And he kind of backed into it. He thought he was starting a little thing. It was kind of before GoFundMe was a big thing. He thought he was starting a little thing to kind of collect money to help somebody's health care bill every month. Kind of collect a dollar or two from a bunch of people and be able to help somebody every month. And eventually he incorporated as a nonprofit, and a guy joined his board who was a lawyer, who was like, "Hey, I found this thing that I don't think enough people know about, which is nonprofit hospitals are legally required to have charity care policies. And you can, make them live up to it, but you've got to know." And Jared, the founder, was like, "Really?" And had to be convinced, had to be shown. And then it was like, "Well, I'm changing the model of this organization right away." And they've
Wow.
been doing this successfully, in Portland for a couple years now. And almost by accident, made a TikTok video, almost kind of on a whim. It was like, "Well, oh, my younger sister, or my young niece is like, you got to get on TikTok." So we made a TikTok, and it's been viewed more than 10 million times, and they're just deluged with thousands and thousands of people saying, "Hey, on the one," some of them saying like, "I did this, it worked, thank you," and others saying, because he offered, "Can you help me make this application?" And they are just grinding their way through these applications. It's the number of, both part, there are some hospitals that hide the ball deliberately. There are some people who just have no idea that the hospital would want to help them. There are hospitals where I'm sure they're just bureaucratic reasons that they haven't been proactive about offering this, but there's evidence that there's billions and billions of dollars every year of charity care that does not get dispensed to people who could use it. And, if a 60-second internet video and, a little follow-up can unlock that, I mean, again, like $3.8 trillion is a lot more than billions and billions.
Yeah.
But like billions and billions sounds pretty good.
It
That's a good
does.
start. Yeah.
Let's not what do they say? Throw the baby out with the bathwater. I'll take a
Yeah.
few billion off the cost of healthcare this year and we'll just build on that every year after. Well, Dan, it has been an absolute pleasure having you here on Healthcare by the Numbers. Are there any final thoughts, any pearls of wisdom or comments you want to leave our audience with?
I have taken up so much of your time. Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, I mean, I think this is a having now done, I was worried before I started that it would be too depressing to do a show on this topic. And so far, no.
You don't
There's
have
so
the bottle of bourbon and blues going right now.
no. I mean, there's just so many people doing so many, inventive, purposeful, smart things. Who and we all that like and I'm just so I personally I'm just like, great for me. I get to spend my time learning about this and sharing what I'm learning. And I hope, I hope it's useful to lots of people because it's really encouraging to me what I get to learn.
Well, I think it is, as evidenced by, people continuing to come back to your shows and express on, your website and on Twitter and others how much, what they've learned and what they've been able to use in their own life. And I think at Caravan Health, right, one of the things we focus on the health systems and finding stories that help patients are, at the end of the day, what drives us. Back when I was a regional vice president and was in charge of my own territory here, I got to meet with all the population health nurses. And some days you sit there and wonder to yourself, these are great changes, right? We are trying to realign the incentives, but is it really having an impact to the people that it matters the most, the patients? And then you sit down with a population health nurse who talks about, cranky Joe, who refused to do anything about their health and they were very bitter. And then a population health nurse took the time to get to know him and found the reason that would make Cranky Joe move, which was going to visit a grandkid that they hadn't been able to visit, got him to lose weight, got their type 1 diabetes well under control. And about 6 months later, got a picture from Cranky Joe that showed him with his grandkids, right? And those are the
Fantastic.
sto
Yeah.
yeah, those are the stories that tell you that we can do this, right? Not only on the patient level, but also at the system level. We incentivize that level of care, and we're going to make a real difference in people's lives.
Every little
So,
bit, man. There's a lot that's right in front of us to do. That's for sure.
absolutely. Well, again, Dan, really enjoyed our time. Thank you so much for
Thanks.
joining us today. For our audience, if you'd like to learn more about Dan and his ongoing work, you can check out armandalegshow.com or Twitter at Arm and a Leg Show. Dan's Twitter is also at Dan Weissman, which is WeissMann. And for everyone listening, I want to thank you. I'm Todd Searles for Caravan Health, and this is Healthcare by the Numbers. Until next time, take care.